Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CoeAndReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CoeAndReview.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 5th of April, 2024. From the Culture section. Annie Lennox donates handwritten Sweet Dreams lyrics to Gaza appeal. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The Scottish singer Annie Lennox has donated handwritten lyrics of the 1983 Eurythmics hit Sweet Dreams to a charity auction, raising money for medical aid in Gaza. The charity Medical Aid for Palestine, for whom the National's fundraiser raised more than £100,000, is hosting a Cinema for Gaza charity auction with a range of one-of-a-kind donations from celebrities in the world of music, film and TV. As well as Lennox's lyrics, people are able to bid for an hour-long Zoom chat with Louis Theroux, a bedtime story from Tilda Swinton, and a signed proof copy of Frankie Boyle's upcoming book. The description of Lennox's lot reads, "Annie Lennox is one of the most iconic, legendary and inspiring voices Scotland has ever produced. Both with the Eurythmics and as a solo artist, her music continues to reverberate around the world, and now she's putting pen to paper for the highest bidder by generously donating a note with handwritten lyrics of timeless hit Sweet Dreams emblazoned on it. Just dreamy. Currently, the highest bid for Lennox's lyrics stands at £4,000. The auction itself has raised more than £60,000 so far." That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday, the 5th of April, 2024, from the News section. Brexit. Food prices to go up as new border rules come in this month. This article is written by Laura Pollock. Food suppliers have warned of higher prices and empty supermarket shelves, thanks to a new post-Brexit border charge being introduced at the end of the month. Importers will have to pay up to £145 to bring small amounts of products, such as cheese, salami and fish, through the Port of Dover or the Eurotunnel from April 30th, according to guidance published on Wednesday. The fee is intended to cover the cost of operating the border control posts introduced after Brexit and will not apply to goods brought into the UK for personal use. The new charges could lead to higher prices for consumers. The Coal Chain Federation's chief executive, Phil Pluck, said, "Ultimately, this will increase business costs and food prices and potentially lower choices for the shopper." Pluck added, "It was extremely disappointing that the charges had been announced at the last minute, leaving businesses with little time to make any necessary changes." He said, "This is in no way helpful to UK-based importers and the whole EU supply chain. It reinforces the government's slapdash approach to a vital part of UK PLC." James Barnes, chairman of the Horticultural Trades Association, said Wednesday's announcement confirms our fears that in just 1 month, UK horticulture's competitiveness will again be hit by a cost hike for no material gain. Adding that the policy feels like it is constructed on the back of an envelope at best, Barnes, warned that the charges would undoubtedly increase costs and increase the likelihood of empty shelves in supermarkets. SNP respond as new Brexit costs come in. Stephen Bonner, MP, said the UK is continually seeing new ways in which Brexit just doesn't work. Having already had to deal with soaring food inflation and a brutal Westminster-made cost-of-living crisis, ordinary Scottish households could see their weekly shop increase further as a result of the Brexit that was forced upon Scotland, he said. Consumers in Scotland have paid a heavy toll for the Brexit they didn't vote for, and every day brings another news story of how Brexit isn't working and the financial challenges it has imposed on ordinary folk. Households in Scotland have been unable to do anything but watch as the cost of living soars, while those with the powers to effect real change and reverse the economic harm created by Brexit sit on their hands at Westminster. Sir Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak, who both continue to champion this failed project and refuse to reverse Brexit, bear responsibility for the economic harm it is causing. He added, "This is the cost of Westminster control over Scotland, showing why, more than ever, we need SNP representatives who will stand up for Scotland and continue to oppose this damaging Brexit." Labour claim to have a plan. Labour Shadow Minister Nick Thomas-Symonds said, "British shoppers and businesses already suffering with the Conservative cost of living crisis will, rightly, be deeply worried about prices being driven up yet again." Labour has warned about the impact of these measures and the potential for chaos with new border checks. With less than a month before their introduction, "We know what the costs will be." Labour has a plan to reduce costly bureaucracy through seeking to negotiate a veterinary agreement with the EU to massively reduce the need for checks, making food cheaper and our businesses more competitive. The fee will be charged per type of product imported and will vary from £10 to £29, depending on the risk products present. It will also be capped at £145 for mixed consignments. UK government defends move. A UK government spokesperson said this was within and at the bottom end of the range which we consulted with industry on. They added, "The charge is designed to recover the costs of operating our world-class border facilities, where essential biosecurity checks will protect our food supply, farmers and environment against costly disease outbreaks entering the UK through the short straits." The charges follow extensive consultation with industry, and a cap has been set specifically to help smaller businesses. "We are committed to supporting businesses of all sizes and across all sectors as they adapt to new border checks and maintaining the smooth flow of imported goods." About a quarter of the UK's food imports pass through Dover and the Channel Tunnel. The introduction of post-Brexit border checks has been delayed several times over fears they could fuel inflation, but began to be introduced from the start of this year. Food inflation has fallen over the past year, reaching 5% in February after hitting 19.6% in March 2023, its highest recorded level for 45 years. That article was written by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Friday, the 5th of April, 2024, from the news section. Payouts for forced installation of prepayment meters drop in the ocean. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The compensation delivered to those who are subject to the forced installation of prepayment meters for both electricity and gas is a drop in the ocean of what's truly owed, according to Citizens Advice Scotland, CAS. Figures released by Ofgem on Thursday show that 1,502 customers have so far received compensation, totalling £342,450, with suppliers planning a further £200,000 of compensation payments for 1,000 more customers. But previous estimates from CAS suggest that in Scotland alone, approximately 23,936 people were forced into a prepayment meter for their electricity supply. For gas, around 12,000 Scots were subject to the same ordeal against their wishes. The charity also highlighted that energy companies had used a backdoor approach by switching smart meters into pay-as-you-go meters without their customers' consent. It's believed around 17,952 people had their smart meters for electricity unknowingly switched, while for gas it's 12,000. Energy spokesman for CAS, Dr. Matthew Lee, said the forced installation of prepayment meters should be banned. It is very welcome that Ofgem and suppliers are working together to get compensation to people who wrongly had prepayment meters installed against their wishes, he said. However, these early figures, totalling 1,502 across the UK, are potentially a drop in the ocean compared to the scale of the problem. In Scotland alone, we estimate tens of thousands of people were forced into pay-as-you-go energy against their wishes. The forced installation of these meters should be banned permanently. For many people, it means energy is a luxury at the start of the month, and then something they have to ration or even go without the further away they get from payday. Anyone who believes they may have been subject to a forced installation and due compensation is encouraged to visit the CAS website. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday, the 5th of April 2024, from the News section. Scotland weather. Met Office issues warnings for snow, rain and wind. This article is written by Andrew Smart. New weather warnings for snow, rain and wind have been issued for much of central and northern Scotland this week. The Meteorological Organisation released three yellow alerts for Friday and Saturday, seeing possible travel disruption and danger to life over the coming days. The weather warning for snow will affect much of the Grampian and the Highlands from around 3 a.m. on Friday, April 5th, until 9 a.m. that same day. The rain warning will affect Glasgow and most of the Central Belt from around 2 a.m. on Friday until 9 a.m. The warning for wind, which forms part of Storm Kathleen, will last between the hours of 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. on Saturday, April 6th. So what has the Met Office said about the snow, wind and rain warnings for Scotland this week? Yellow weather warning for snow, Friday, April 5th. Some roads and railways likely to be affected, with longer journey times by road, bus and train services. Yellow weather warning for rain, Friday, April 5th. There is a chance of flooding to a few homes and businesses. Spray and flooding on roads probably making journey times longer. Bus and train services probably affected with journey times taking longer. Yellow weather warning for wind, Saturday, April 6th. There is a small chance of longer or even cancelled journeys as road, rail, air and ferry services are affected. There is a small chance that some roads and bridges could close or impose restrictions. There is a slight chance that power cuts may occur, with the potential to affect other services, such as mobile phone coverage. There is a small chance that injuries and danger to life could occur from large waves and beach material being thrown onto seafronts, coastal roads and properties. These weather warnings are subject to change and may alter ahead of Friday and Saturday. That article was written by Andrew Smart. This is from The National on Friday, the 5th of April 2024, from the comments section. Why freeports are basically tax havens. This article is written by Professor Richard Murphy. The National series on green freeports this week is important precisely because of the risks that they pose. I have been involved in tax justice campaigning for more than 20 years now, which is about as long as anyone on the planet has been. In that time, I have become increasingly aware of how dangerous the deeply cynical proposals made by right-wing politicians for the creation of entities like freeports really are. The narratives that the proponents of such things use is always alluring. They are, however, based upon the idea that freedom from regulation and taxation is the foundation for prosperity. This is total nonsense. It is not chance that the most taxed and regulated countries in the world are also the most prosperous, but that is always the case, most especially if we take the more obvious tax havens like Luxembourg, Ireland, the Netherlands, and the Cayman Islands out of consideration. It is also very obviously true, on the basis of even the most superficial observation, that those countries with low levels of taxation and regulation are almost always associated with high levels of crime, low levels of income for the population as a whole, unstable government, and corruption. Regulation and taxation that supports it are necessary. Without them, world trade competes without rules and mayhem results. A sporting analogy helps here. As we all know, every sport is dependent upon rules and regulations. Sporting competition only exists because there are umpires, referees, and others to monitor compliance with those rules. Markets are the same. They too require regulation, but the whole logic of freeports is to pretend otherwise. They try to create artificial advantages for one team over all others, as if your favourite team could always play with 12 people on the pitch when opponents were restricted to 11. Rigging the rules does not help competition. It destroys it. That is bad enough, but in practice, freeports are even more insidious than that. As those who promote them know, there is a very particular, practical problem with them. In the academic field of political economy in which I work, we call that a boundary issue. If you look at the map of where Scotland's freeports are located, you will see that they cover remarkably large areas. You will also note that there are no natural boundaries around these territories. So, the obvious question arises, which is how do we know what happens within a freeport and what happens elsewhere? When what happens in a freeport is favoured, with the rules heavily biased in their favour, this question matters. For example, is a company employee who works at two locations in the course of their work, which is easy enough to do, with one in a freeport and the other not, subject to the tax exemptions that the freeport provides to their employer or not? Who decides? And who monitors the decision-making on this issue, or a free-for-all result? In reality, if freeport problems were all as simple as that, we might find solutions for the problems that they create. However, by definitions, freeports exist to facilitate trade, and trade means flows of goods and services. At present, there are relatively few advantages for locating these in a freeport, but you can be sure that it is the intention to change this. When I took part in freeport consultations with the Westminster-based HM Treasury before they were introduced and questioned what they might eventually be used for, I was told to presume that if I could imagine something being done in a freeport, then one day that might happen. I based my comments on that suggestion. In that case, politicians desperate for growth at any price will, almost inevitably, succumb to the voices in their ears, whispered by highly paid lobbyists, to eventually allow concessions relating to trade, tariffs, VAT and other issues within freeports. When that happens, the problem with freeports will snowball. In particular, how will we know where the boundary of the freeport is and whether the right amount of tax has been paid in the right place, at the right rate and at the right time? This will be especially the case if regulation of this issue has been outsourced to the free market promoter of the freeport itself, which would be unsurprising when HM Revenue and Customs has almost no offices in Scotland now. The opportunities for abuse will expand many times over, and I am quite sure that this is the intention of those who promote these activities. Freeports exist to create borders where none naturally exist, based on the certain knowledge of their promoters that borders always create an opportunity for tax and regulatory abuse. I am hardly being radical when saying so. The centuries-old history of smuggling, customs abuse, and much else confirms what I am saying. The result is that freeports can result in the creation of what can be best described as a criminogenic environment, that is, a place where the effective operation of law might be suspended because no one has the willingness or capacity to enforce what regulation there is. In that sense, freeports are exactly like tax havens, as evidence from Europe confirms. Forget the greenwash and forget the supposed hype about job creation in that case, not least because freeports only relocate jobs at best. Freeports are about giving employers and companies a free ride at cost to the people of Scotland. The history of tax-motivated regulatory abuse makes that clear. Scotland would be very wise to take note. That article was written by Professor Richard Murphy.
This is from The National on Monday, 8th April 2024. From the Politics section. Labour MP David Lammy launches personal defence of Union flag. By Xander Elliards. Labour will never stop waving the Union flag, one of the party's most senior MPs has insisted amid a row over the design appearing on general election campaign material. David Lammy wrote what he called a personal piece in The Sun defending the use of the Union flag on Labour campaign flyers after concerns were raised about how it was perceived in some constituencies. In late March, The Guardian reported that Labour leader Keir Starmer was facing discontent from Labour MPs over the use of the flag, amid fears it could alienate minority voters and those in university towns. For a lot of communities, we are talking about colours that are associated with the National Front or another far-right group, one MP told the paper. Another added, "You don't need to prove your patriotism by wrapping yourself in the Union Jack." Labour have also added the Union flag to their membership cards in a move which was praised by the far-right leader of Britain First. However, writing in the right-wing paper The Sun, Shadow Foreign Secretary Lammy said anyone complaining about the Union flag on Labour material had it wrong. "It was the flag that went to battle against Hitler's racism," Lammy wrote. "I've always felt abandoning it to racists was a betrayal of its anti-fascist heritage." Which is why those uneasy about the Union Jack on our leaflets have it wrong. "The flag doesn't belong to those who once tried to intimidate me. It's everybody's, be they black or white. That's why my party proudly flies it, and we will never stand it down." Lammy's comments have been widely mocked, with the Aberdeen Independence Movement responding on social media, "Put the flag down, David. You can't shag it. What are these nationalists like?" the Liverpool Community Independence Group, founded by former Labour members, responded, "When this country fought Hitler's evil regime, it had an empire which was the epitome of racism itself. It fought to defend the British Empire, not to fight racism." Previously, Starmer infuriated Labour activists by writing in The Sun, despite having told a crowd in Liverpool that he wouldn't talk to that paper, which has never been forgiven in that city for its coverage of the Hillsborough disaster. Similar anger was widespread in the responses to Lammy's argument for the Union flag. The top Labour MP's comments were further called out by Yes Cymru director Ethan Jones, who said, "The Union flag does nothing for me. I feel no affinity. My country isn't represented on it." Invoking Hitler isn't a trump card. It was also carried into battle against the United States, the Jacobites, the Maori, and flew over concentration camps in Kenya. The empire is over. Park it. That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National on Monday, 8th April 2024, from the News section. Police launch investigation after willful gorse fire in Moray by Ross Hunter. An investigation has been launched following a willful gorse fire which damaged a large area of ground. Police Scotland has said it is hoping to identify three male youths seen at the Strathlean area between Buckie and Findochty on Saturday evening. Emergency services were alerted to the fire at around 8:45 p.m. with the blaze extinguished by the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service. There were no injuries, but police said a large area of land was damaged. Police are looking to identify a teenage boy around the age of 15 who is described as having long curly red hair, of slim build and wearing a blue jacket. The second is believed to be older than the first and is described as tall, wearing a jacket with a blue tick. The third boy is believed to be smaller than the other two and was carrying a man bag, police said. Police Constable Christopher McKinnon said, "We are carrying out inquiries and the fire is being treated as willful. Fortunately, no one was injured. However, a large area of ground has been damaged. As part of our investigation, we're trying to identify three male youths seen in the area around this time. The first is described as around 15 years old, long curly red hair, slim build, wearing a blue jacket. The second was older than the first, tall, wearing a jacket with a blue tick. The third was smaller than the others and carrying a man bag. We're also asking anyone in the area with private CCTV to check it and get in touch if there's anything that could assist with our inquiries. Anyone with information is asked to call Police Scotland on 101, quoting incident number 3444 of Saturday, April 6th, 2024, or get in touch with Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111. That article was by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Monday, 8th of April, 2024, from the News section. Scottish farmers hope for drier summer as rain and crop prices fall. By Nan Sport. It's officially spring, and lambs should be gambolling in the fields while farmers sow the barley necessary for Scotland's world-famous whisky. Instead, the lambs are shivering on sodden ground beside their mothers as the rain lashes down, and the farmers monitor the gloomy forecast with increasing concern. Extreme rainfall over the winter has extended into spring, affecting not only the crops that should be sown now, but also wheat and oilseed rape sown following last year's harvest. "It would be a disaster if we couldn't get the barley in the ground," said Jack Stevenson, who farms at Boindy near Banff and is chair of NFU Scotland's Combinable Crops Committee. "Probably about 80% of the crops around here are spring barley for the maltsters, so we've got all our eggs in one basket." He added, "My dad said this morning that he'd never known a spring like it. It's very worrying. I've never seen us have a crop failure, but it is a worry, and a worry for the maltsters and merchants because they are committed to supplying the Diegos and the Glenlivets or Macallans of this world. I don't think the distillers are worried just yet, but if it is still the same at the end of April, it will be a different story. Rain is not all that is falling. Prices for crops have dropped while costs have continued to rise to the point where many of Scotland's farmers are starting to wonder if they will break even come harvest time. It would really be a disaster for the Scottish cereals farming industry if we didn't get a crop in the ground," said Stevenson. "We have fertiliser and machinery bills and rents to be paid, so we can't just miss a harvest. There would be a lot of pressure on the banks to then extend overdrafts, and I think they would be unwilling to do that in some cases. I hope that never happens, but it is a worry." The vagaries of the weather, along with high machinery and fertiliser costs, means that maintaining good mental health is becoming more and more of an issue in the farming sector, according to Stevenson. "These are challenging times, and in our industry, a lot of farmers are working by themselves, and it is tough," he said. "We don't like to be doom and gloom all the time, as we are in a job that we love and are pretty resilient, but you do worry about people working by themselves. We just seem to be getting more weather dependent now, and our inputs are spiralling. Machinery costs alone have risen by around 35% over the last few years, with a brand new combine harvester now costing in the region of £500,000, while even a small tractor costs at least £100,000. "It's crazy money," said Stevenson. "Costs went up when oil got really expensive, but we've never seen the costs come down, which is worrying. Fertilisers and fungicides also remain expensive, and there is concern the poor weather will reduce the yields of crops sown before winter begins. If we all struggle to get stuff on at the right time, and there are bare bits already, I would say we will be losing money, to be honest," said Scott Campbell of Kirkton Farm and Kinnear near Aberdeen. "If we can't get the nitrogen and sprays on at the correct time, there will be more disease coming into the crop, and the wheat will be poorer in yield and quality. For winter wheat, we try to get over 4 tonnes an acre to make it profitable. We need the tonnes and the price to make the margin. What I'm concerned about is that the forecast doesn't seem to be any better." Campbell said that if not enough fertiliser is applied and the fungicides are sprayed at the wrong time, then yields could be cut substantially, meaning farmers would struggle to cover their costs and the UK would have to rely more on imports. "Importing is not good for the environment, and chemicals that are banned here are allowed on wheat grown in the US and Ukraine," said Campbell, who is also a member of the Combinable Crops Committee. "Here we already have good practices with farm assurance, sprayer MOTs and operator training, and we are doing all we can for the environment. But the bottom line is, we can't keep spending money on these if we can't make a profit. The problem is Scotland-wide, so everyone is in the same boat. With more rain on the way this week, farmers will be fervently hoping it dries up soon." That article was by Nan Sport.
From The National,
Wednesday the 10th of April, from the news section. Bid to build a 125-metre-high wind turbine rejected by Scottish Council, by Drew Sandilands. A bid to build an almost 125-metre-high wind turbine near Neilston has been rejected after planners warned it would have a significant detrimental impact on the landscape. Officials at East Renfrewshire Council recommended the application was turned down as the scale and design of the proposed turbine were considered well beyond what the local area can accommodate. Andy Brand of Nether Carswell 3 Limited had applied for permission to erect the turbine on a site to the south of Nether Carswell Cottage, Kingston Road, Neilston, in September 2020. The application claimed the development was acceptable and the visual impact would not be significant. However, councillors on the planning committee supported the view of the officials and refused to grant planning permission. Councillor Jim McLean, Conservative, who chaired the planning committee meeting, said, "I think it's very, very big in comparison to what we currently have there. In the papers we currently have, there is no mention of any community benefit coming back from this. On these grounds, I would favour the planner's recommendation to refuse." The bid to build a 125 metres high turbine received 20 objections, with a range of concerns including the noise and visual impact, as well as the lack of community benefit from the installation. It would have generated around 4.2 megawatts of electric power and had an operational life of around 25 years. There are currently two turbines operating near the site, Nether Carswell 1 and 2. Officials reported the turbine was of much larger scale with a much greater rotor diameter than its fellow Nether Carswell turbines. They added, "The closest site to the application turbines are the existing Nether Castle turbines 1 and 2. Respectively, these turbines have blades tips heights of 77 metres and 80 metres, some 33% smaller than the proposed NC3 turbine. While planning policies encourage renewable energy development, planners said the turbine is not in keeping with the prevailing scale of turbine development in the area. This additional height and its particularly large rotor sweep results in a significantly larger active form with a resultant detrimental impact on the local landscape and aspects from local landmarks, for example, Neilston Pad," they added. A report by officials concluded the proposal raises significant issues when considered against the development plan. It said, "Principally, these relate to the scale and design of the proposed turbine, which is considered well beyond what the local area can accommodate with a significant detrimental landscape and residential amenity impacts." Councillor Andrew Morrison, Conservative, said, "We know the value of renewable energy, but here we are talking about 4.2 megawatts, which sounds a lot, but in terms of the country's energy needs, it's actually quite small. We've got to balance that need for renewable energy with sympathy for the amenity of the area and the environment." Planners said a decision on the application had been delayed from 2020 due to the ongoing consideration of a complaint regarding turbine noise from a local resident and the lack of a consultation response from Prestwick Airport. An article was written by Drew Sandilands. From the National, Wednesday the 10th of April, from the news section, 5 people arrested as red paint sprayed over Ministry of Defence, report by Gregor Young. Pro-Palestine protesters have sprayed red paint over the Ministry of Defence headquarters in London. The groups Youth Demand and Palestine Action jointly carried out the action on Wednesday, demanding that both the Conservative and Labour parties commit to imposing a two-way arms embargo on Israel. The activists also demand an end to all future licensing for the exploration, development and production of fossil fuels in the UK, including revoking oil and gas licences issued since 2021. It comes after Foreign Secretary David Cameron said the UK won't end arms sales to Israel, despite grave concerns. In a video posted to X, formerly Twitter, several demonstrators can be seen spraying the red paint over the walls of the building before displaying a banner reading, "Youth demand an end to genocide." In a post to the Metropolitan Police official X account, The force said five people had been arrested on the suspicion of criminal damage and are in custody. They wrote, "We will never tolerate people causing criminal damage to buildings under the guise of protest." In a statement, Youth Demand said, "Young people will not accept the future those in charge have in store for us. We will not die quietly whilst our leaders commit us to a future of suffering and mass death. Young people are coming together to fight back." On Monday, the group sprayed Labour's headquarters with red paint and on Tuesday held a demonstration outside Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer's home. And that was an article written by Gregor Young. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of April, from the news section, exclusive. Glasgow Rangers pub bans filming and sectarian songs amid hate crime fears. Report by Hamish Morrison. A famous Glasgow Rangers pub has launched a crackdown on bigoted singing and banned customers from filming on the premises amid concerns about new hate crime laws. The Bristol Bar has introduced new measures banning sectarian songs, including anti-Catholic lyrics added to Rangers anthem Simply the Best by Tina Turner. They have also banned filming on the premises over concerns drunk patrons may get themselves into trouble with their employers or the law if they're recorded singing sectarian songs. The owner of the Duke Street pub has created leaflets to give to patrons, telling them that customers are now banned from using their phones to record anything within these premises, saying the new rules had come into effect after the Hate Crime Act went live on April the 1st. He said he feared the pub losing its licence if sectarian incidents were reported to the police and the measures had been introduced after speaking with local licensing officers. "I just don't want anyone getting into any bother. I just don't want the bar. I just don't want the bad press," he said, "because we're trying our best and it all takes this one wee stupid F asterisk deleted thing like this to undo everything I've been doing for the last 7 months." Of the pub's new filming ban, the Bristol Bar's owner said a customer had lost his job as an accountant because he was recorded singing sectarian songs. The leaflets also notify customers that the Bristol Bar operates a zero tolerance policy on sectarian songs, song add-ons or offensive singing. Add-ons refer to the lyrics added them to popular songs sung by football fans. Some Ranger fans add the lyrics F asterisk 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 the Pope and the IRA to Tina Turner's Simply the Best. The Bristol Bar's owner said the pub's new rules meant that if customers added in those lyrics while the song played, it would be turned off and customers would be reminded of the rules. "The customers are all great with it, they're all buying into it," he said. The leaflets were produced for Saturday's Flag Day, where the pub and its surrounds are decked in Rangers flags from around the world, with customers flying in from far-flung places like Chicago and Australia before the following day's Old Firm match. The pub's owner said he was concerned they would be unfamiliar with new hate crime laws in Scotland. The Hate Crime Act, which came into force on April the 1st, creates a new criminal offence of stirring up hatred on religious grounds. Former Rangers player Ali McCoy sparked controversy before the Old Firm when he said he could guarantee he and other supporters would be committing hate crimes on the terraces of Ibrox when the team played against Celtic. And that article was written by Hamish Morrison. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of April, from the news section, Scottish Labour MP hopeful Wilma Brown suspended from party. Report by Steph Braun. Scottish Labour general election candidate Wilma Brown has been suspended from the party after she shared dozens of offensive tweets on social media. The Cowdenbeath and Kirkcaldy candidate was found to have liked and reposted a swathe of racist, Islamophobic and transphobic posts on Twitter/X on Tuesday. These included posts claiming the Scottish Government aid to Gaza was going to Hamas, and messages that featured the debunked viral claim that Humza Yousaf had said there are too many white people in Scotland. Last month, Brown also liked a racist post telling an Indian man who was expressing his love for England and its flag, "You will never be an Englishman and it is not your flag." Brown has additionally been found to have liked posts claiming trans broadcaster India Willoughby incited trans activists to harass TV judge Robert Reinder, as well as tweets suggesting J.K. Rowling had slain the trans movement. Elsewhere, she had shared posts calling for the abolition of the Scottish Parliament or for it to be placed under special measures by the British government. Shortly after The National exposed her behaviour in social media, Brown deleted her Twitter account. The party has now opted to suspend her pending the outcome of any investigation, it is understood. A private Twitter/X account for her local campaign also appears to have vanished in the last few hours. A Labour Party spokesperson says, "The Labour Party takes all complaints seriously. They are fully investigated in line with our rules and procedures, and any appropriate action is taken." The tweets shared and liked by Brown have been branded deeply offensive by the SNP's Keith Brown, who has called for Labour leader Keir Starmer to explain how she was allowed to become a candidate. Green MSP Maggie Chapman said, "While it is right Brown has been suspended, the revelations bring Labour's whole selection process into question." She said, "It's shocking that Labour put up someone with such openly ignorant, bigoted and racist views to represent the people of Scotland. It's right that Wilma Brown has now been suspended, but if she managed to get selected, we'll obviously have to question the competence of Labour's whole selection process. How can anyone trust a process that tried to place these beliefs into a position of such prominence and power?" The National has approached Brown directly, but she has not provided any comment. And that article was written by Steph Braun and read by me, Ian McKenna. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of April, from the comment section: "Big changes are coming for the EU's single market." An opinion piece by Alan Smith. An independent Scotland's membership of the EU will put rocket boosters on our economy instead of being hamstrung by the UK's stagnating decline. I recognise that I am lightly preaching to the choir here, but as I've outlined in a few of my previous articles, there is no serious debate in the independence movement around where Scotland's best future lies. Other options are substandard and would be against our best interests. Fundamental to this is membership of the EU's single market, arguably its biggest asset, and one which we benefited from membership of for nearly three decades. Yet the single market we will look to join will be different to the one we've left. Ahead of a special European Council, taking place on April the 17th to 18th, EU leaders are expected to call for a deepening of the single market, as well as to see tangible progress towards a capital markets union. Contrary to the skewed image portrayed by large parts of the UK media, the EU is not a stagnant institution, but one which continuously looks to improve itself and develop an environment beneficial to its citizens. The single market was established on November 1, 1993. With its establishment, EU member states created an area without any internal borders or other regulatory obstacles, and for the four freedoms of people, goods, services and capital. Today, from Riga in the Baltics to Valletta in the Mediterranean, and Dublin in Ireland, euros and people flow seamlessly where once there were numerous bureaucratic obstacles, as the UK now experiences on a daily basis with the EU. The single market is the engine which drives the largest economy in the world and its largest trading bloc. A lot has changed in those 30 years. The digital age ushered the internet into all our homes and phones. Climate change is reshaping our environment and causing severe disruption for communities across our planet. The EU itself has changed, enlarging from 12 members in 1993 to 27 today, with other states such as Ukraine, Georgia and Albania all looking to accede. The world is ever changing and the EU recognises that it must continually adapt if it is to succeed in a more unstable geopolitical landscape. The Commission's website outlines some of the barriers within the single market it is looking to eliminate over time, such as how to facilitate a more seamless flow of energy, capital and goods, regulatory harmonisation, as well as simplification of rules on the recognition of vocational qualifications. How these challenges may be addressed could depend upon upcoming reports from two former Italian prime ministers. Enrico Letta's report on the future of the single market and former European Central Bank President Mario Draghi's report on the future of European competitiveness are likely points of conversation at the Special European Council. Some of their proposals have already been widely discussed and have been around for years, such as harmonisation of the bloc's bankruptcy and corporate tax laws, as well as completing the creation of a capital markets union. A new European competitiveness deal would look to deepen the single market by removing barriers, ensuring more effective enforcement of existing rules, empowering smaller companies, increasing investment in digital infrastructure and use of artificial intelligence, and developing a more supportive environment for research and commercial innovation. Contrast this with the rather weak beer solutions offered by both the Tory and Labour parties here, and it is clear to see the direction of economic travel. The EU may be engaged in highly complex discussions of economic reform, but that is a good thing. Governments are meant to improve their citizens' lives, and this means not shying away from difficult conversations and intense debates. Neither the Tories nor Labour are offering a remedy to the current economic decline successive UK governments have presided over and subsequently accelerated by Brexit. Indeed, the Labour Party seem intent on doubling down on Tory failures by refusing to consider rejoining either the single market or the customs union, both policies which, at a stroke, would do wonders for your income, the businesses that operate on our shores, as well as the public purse. We are all aware of the economic and infrastructure challenges facing us. The Scottish Government is doing what it can, but while we are tethered to the UK, it will only be able to operate with both hands tied behind its back as Westminster holds economic levers. Around half of Scots back independence, our challenge is to ensure that we present a compelling vision to bring more on side. As we look enviously across the sea to our European neighbours, who get on with the serious business of governing Europe's citizens, we can see the opportunities that independence will bring to the people of Scotland. Let's make sure that those who are undecided are aware that there is an alternative to the stagnating Westminster status quo: independence in Europe. And that was a comment piece by Alan Smith. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of April, from the comment section: France shows vicious circle that Labour NHS plans will start. By Asa Samaki Roman, columnist. I've always been intrigued by the strong attachment the British have to the NHS. Maybe because I didn't grow up here, I don't quite share the same adoration and fondness. But don't get me wrong, I absolutely love it. The NHS is a remarkable thing to have, a necessary thing too. However, over time, that same sentiment started to grow. So, whenever there is a conversation about the future of the NHS, it does feel very personal. When I gave birth and relied on the NHS, I saw firsthand the dedication of the healthcare staff. They were stretched so thin, working tirelessly to provide care. Unfortunately, there simply weren't enough of them, so I felt I didn't receive the support I needed having a baby in pretty traumatic conditions. My birth experience, one of the most beautiful and intense moments of my life, is laced with painful memories of feeling unsupported and overlooked by a system struggling to meet demands. In France, where my mum works as a nurse, I hear similar stories. Local hospitals struggle to find enough nurses to properly care for patients. Funding decisions made by successive governments have left hospitals in dire straits for more than two decades. The over-reliance on outsourcing may offer short-term relief, but ultimately worsens the situation in the long run. Outsourcing health and social care refers to transferring services, such as operations, inpatient care or community services, to for-profit firms rather than having the public health service or local authorities provide them directly. In French hospitals, both in rural areas and cities, there is a significant understaffing issue. To address this, interim nurses are often brought in. These nurses are typically better paid than full-time public hospital nurses, but they lack job security. However, because hospitals everywhere desperately need staff and struggle with recruitment, interim nurses are in high demand and rarely out of work. They have the freedom to choose where they want to go, consequently making the system more unstable. Consequently, hospital wards struggle more, spending more and more money, putting additional pressure on existing nurses and worsening their working conditions. This situation leads some nurses to consider becoming interim nurses themselves. It is a vicious circle with increased costs which delivers suboptimal outcomes. As a response to this concern, a recent law enacted at the end of last year, championed by a Conservative MP and supported by the French government, banned early career health professionals from going directly into interim work without serving in the public sector first. Across the political spectrum on the continent, there is a growing recognition that outsourcing isn't a silver bullet to solve healthcare challenges. Countries such as Spain have even contemplated legislation to rein in private healthcare outsourcing. However, in its characteristic manner of being slightly behind the curve, the UK is ready to reach a similar stage of realisation. Labour's Shadow Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has stirred up controversy by expressing his willingness to hold the door wide open to private healthcare companies to support the NHS. Despite facing criticism within his own party, Streeting stands firm in his position. He is unswayed by criticism from what he views as middle-class lefties who oppose the idea of using the private sector to alleviate waiting lists. Streeting insists on the importance of providing timely access to care for those in need, prioritising practical solutions over ideology. He says, "I don't think I could look someone in the eye who's waiting for months and months, sometimes over a year, in pain and agony for treatment, and tell him that they should wait longer because my principles trump their timely access to care." It's difficult to disagree with that. We cannot and should not accept a system where individuals are forced to endure pain or delay necessary treatments due to delays and ever-expanding waiting lists. The yearly Audit Scotland report in Scotland's health service showed that the NHS was dealing with rising costs, patients had to wait longer to see doctors, and there weren't enough staff available. In parallel, private hospital admissions in Scotland are escalating rapidly, fueled by a surge in people opting for privately funded treatments. Last year, approximately 1 in every 486 Scots underwent a self-funded or insurance-funded procedure in a private hospital, compared to 1 in every 275 in England. It is no surprise that finding a solution is urgent, but it is important to realise that outsourcing isn't a new solution and we already know it's not a long-term fix. As governments deal with financial strains and an ageing population, there is a growing trend of outsourcing healthcare to private companies. This is because nobody is too keen on raising taxes to fund healthcare and the perception that governments cannot afford to invest more in the system. Consequently, outsourcing is seen as a way to cut costs while theoretically maintaining the quality of care. However, in reality, outsourcing often doesn't work as well as hoped. According to Benjamin Goodair and Aaron Reeves from the University of Oxford, studies typically find that increases in for-profit outsourcing correspond with increases in mortality rates from treatable causes. In fact, despite the hopes for privatisation as a route to discover efficiency gains, it turns out that outsourcing is actually damaging for population health. To clarify, it's not that the private sector is inherently dangerous. Nevertheless, the poorer outcomes associated with it can be attributed to various factors, according to these academics. For example, for-profit providers often have less training, worse working conditions, and fewer staff compared to public providers. These differences in approach to service provision likely contribute to the worst outcomes seen for the for-profit providers. Another thing to worry about is the ripple effect of outsourcing. It can put public hospitals in a tough spot when it comes to keeping up their usual standard of care. There is a chance the private sector will lure more staff away from public hospitals over time because the pay is better. That's a significant shift already happening. In 2021-22, a whopping 38% of nurses who left their NHS registered nursing job but stayed in the workforce moved into roles in private hospitals, agencies or charities. This trend highlights the growing competition for healthcare professionals between the public and private sectors, which could further strain the resources and quality of care in public hospitals. Additionally, there is a related concern that NHS clinicians may experience an increase in the proportion of complex and chronic cases compared to simpler, easier to treat problems that are more easily outsourced. The ongoing crisis in the NHS doesn't come out of the blue. It isn't bad luck. It is absolutely linked to years of systematic underfunding during the tenure of consecutive Conservative governments spanning a 14-year period. Add to that the lack of a comprehensive social care policy, the impact of Brexit and the pandemic, inflation, and now health spending in England is set to undergo a significant 1.2% cut, equivalent to £2 billion in the coming financial year, the largest cut in real terms since the 1970s. This is, as we say in French, the remedy that kills the patient. What alarms me is that after 14 years in opposition, it appears that the future Labour government, unless, in a crazy turn of events, the Tories miraculously win the next general election, lacks a sense of innovation or forward thinking. I am just not sure how applying the recipes of the past is going to deliver better results. The externalisation of public services was brought in precisely because of the same issues we are facing now. What is it going to solve now that it didn't solve before? And that was a comment piece by Asa Samaki Roman. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of April, from the comments section. LGBTQ plus people like me need your support now more than ever. By columnist Caitlin Logan. Hopelessness is, I believe, the most dangerous emotion because it gives us permission to stop trying and it places all the cards in the hands of those who seek to quell our thirst for progress. On the edge of this perilous place is where I have found myself walking while the weight of anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric and its growing influence presses down on me. When your working life involves, as mine does, a mixture of campaigning for social and political change and writing about your opinions and various injustices, a strange sort of distance develops between your emotional self and the issues you confront each day. This is necessary both for self-preservation and for any cause you are committed to, because there are times when to truly look at the despair of the situation in the eye would be to give in to it and give up altogether. But this wall of protection can only withstand so much for so long. I am a queer woman, a lesbian, a supporter of trans people, and the past few years have been exhausting. Every other week, it seems there is another onslaught that leaves me feeling that the low point must, by now, have been reached. Yet, somehow, it keeps getting worse. If the hostility towards trans people and the LGBTQ plus people more generally, which has defined the most fevered reactions to the new hate crime legislation over the past couple of weeks, is any indication of where we are as a country, it is a sad day indeed. I do not for a minute believe that the majority in Scotland are represented by those who attended a rally in Edinburgh, organised by extreme anti-trans activist Kelly J. Keane Minshall, or who protested outside the Scottish Parliament alongside the likes of the Christian Right Scottish Family Party, or are in front of the third-party hate crime reporting sites like Glasgow's queer sex shop Lookin' Jack. However, the level of attention and credence afforded to these individuals across the Scottish media and by elected representatives is alarming. Over a number of years now, there has been a widespread campaign to legitimise viewpoints on LGBTQ plus rights, which I truly believe were on the way out, and our political and media institutions have willingly, sometimes gleefully, promoted it. One has to wonder if some of those doing this cynically are under the impression that their actions exist in some kind of bubble, or if the real-world consequences and the pain, fear and isolation that it has instilled in many LGBTQ plus people is a sacrifice worth making to score a few points in their political game. I would not pretend to know how it feels for trans people in Scotland today as they witness the highest profile celebrity in their country become the face of a global hate movement against their right to live and be accepted for who they are. I can't imagine waking up every day to another 16 news and opinion pieces about a never-ending debate over my right to be called by my name and treated with dignity, and how this might spell the downfall of an entire government. But, seeing the predictable spread of this furore to encompass anything related to the letters LGBTQ, while claims of wanting to protect children from this ideology abound, I do know something about watching on, helpless, as the sense of safety and inclusion that our predecessors worked so hard to achieve for us slips away. Every day I reassure myself of the things that matter, that the Scottish Government speaks up in support of LGBTQ plus rights and is progressing with actions to back this up, like a conversion therapy ban, and that most people do support equality and acceptance for all, irrespective of sexual orientation or gender identity. I remind myself that it's just that those who are the loudest are most often the ones who are heard. But therein lies the problem. Too many of those who know the way LGBTQ plus people are being weaponized is wrong and keeping quiet. I understand. There are countless different issues playing on all of our minds each day, and we don't always have the energy to speak up or get involved in all of them, particularly when a topic generates such ferocious debate. It can feel safer to keep your head down and wait for the moment to pass. And really, if it's mostly been driven by an extreme fringe anyway, is there a point in engaging with it? As someone who has paid a lot of attention to how this has unfolded, even as a queer person myself, I have fallen into some of this thinking. For a time, I convinced myself this was only online, or it was mostly outside of Scotland, or it was just the media drumming up clickbait, or it was the Tories, or it wouldn't really stop legislation being introduced, or these people wouldn't actually show up in person to events and divert the conversation away from other important topics. Or, surely, I wouldn't be faced with people in my daily life regurgitating these same views, people I hoped I could respect, who I believed respected me, and who I was sure would know better. It's difficult now to pinpoint the exact moment in time when I should have realised that things were even worse than I had imagined. I can't turn back the clock, but what I can do is let you know, and ask you to let your friends know, to let their family know, to let their colleagues know. The time for naivety is long gone. The power of misinformation is almost unfathomable, and the conditions for it to thrive in Scotland are optimal. We can, and must, do something about it. Reading last month that the Scottish Parliament had decided to ban rainbow lanyards for staff because of a requirement to remain impartial, at the same time as ending its membership of Stonewall's Diversity Champions programme, after 11 years, it felt like a gut punch. For these decisions to be made at this political and cultural moment, in the knowledge that this would be leapt upon by sections of the media and claimed as a victory by the people who would rather see LGBTQ plus people pushed out of public life altogether, the Parliament has sent a very clear message: the fight for equality will never end. As long as there are people willing to push back hard enough on progress, what is accepted now can once again become controversial. For some of these engaged in those seemingly endless arguments or watching on from the sidelines, it might look like a political debate. It might seem like just another day of media soundbites or treacherous Twitter storms, probably the best ignored. For many of us, though, ignoring it isn't an option. It's real life. It's personal, it hurts, and it's only getting harder. We need your help. I need your help. I believe hope is worth holding on to, but progress will only be possible if every single one of us who does not wish to see the clock turn back on the LGBTQ plus inclusion says so. We can still be the louder voice if enough of us choose to speak. And that was a comment piece by Caitlin Logan, columnist.
The National, Thursday the 11th of April, from the news section. Glasgow Central and Waverley are first UK stations to bring in a major change. Glasgow Central and Edinburgh Waverley are the first stations in the UK to introduce a major new change. The busy stations will be the first to install information screens with British Sign Language. British Sign Language will appear on the main boards and the sub-boards as part of a plan to make the railway more accessible for deaf passengers. Network Rail teamed up with the British Deaf Association Scotland, who offered their insight and guidance throughout the project. The latest information on trains coming from Network Rail's control room will be converted to British Sign Language on the displays in real time. While the boards currently only show train information, they will soon be able to show emergency and security messages and information that could impact journeys. Graham Smith, Regional Telecoms Asset and Performance Manager of Network Rail, said, "We value the positive impact that having BSL displayed on our main and subboards can have for our deaf passengers. We hope this will not only help in our communications efforts for passengers with hearing difficulties, but will provide those customers with a better experience on Scottish Railways. We've heard that as a result of the work we're doing in Scotland, there are five other major stations who now want to follow our lead. So I'm really proud to see Scotland's railway blazing this trail." Avril Hepner, British Sign Language Scotland manager for BDA Scotland, said, "There are a number of challenges that we face when travelling by train. It's very easy to end up on the wrong platform or on the wrong train, especially when there are platform changes or delays, and we can't hear the live announcements. These digital BSL information boards will benefit deaf travellers greatly. They'll improve accessibility and independence, but will also give confidence to passengers that they're up to date with travel information and able to get to the right train at the right time. Having this vital information in British Sign Language brings hope that many more BSL users have the confidence to travel independently by train." Work to install the screens was carried out in partnership with contractors Amco Giffen, JMP Group and LB Foster. Ian Mackay, Telecoms Contracts Manager at Amco Giffen, said, "Amco Giffen is proud to be part of this groundbreaking project, helping to create an inclusive environment for all passengers. We worked closely with Network Rail's team, station managers and key supply chain partners to commission and install these BSL displays that not only enhance accessibility, but will also foster a sense of belonging, helping to make all passengers feel welcome and accommodated on Scotland's railways." This was an article by Rebecca Newlands. The National, Thursday, the 11th of April, from the news section. Hate Crime Act does not make it illegal to be an asshole. Scottish Green MSP Ross Greer has said the Scottish Government's Hate Crime Act has not made it illegal to be an asshole. The legislation came in force last week in Scotland, with police confirming they received 7,152 complaints in the first week of the operation. It consolidated previous hate crime legislation and created a new offence of stirring up hatred against certain protected characteristics. Many have taken to social media to criticise the bill, including Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who made a number of posts on the first day the law was in force, misgendering a number of trans people. She said she was looking forward to being arrested, although police did not take any action against the writer. Speaking to the BBC political podcast, Greer said it had not been made illegal to be unpleasant or offensive. "It is not illegal to be an asshole now," he said. "It was not illegal to be an asshole before, and for the last week it has still not been illegal to be an asshole." But he added, "That doesn't mean you should be." Greer stressed that he was not specifically referring to the Harry Potter author, but was making a generalisation. He continued, "Just because it is still legal to be offensive doesn't mean you should go out of your way to be offensive. There are plenty of things that it's not illegal to do, but that in a decent society we don't generally encourage people to do. We should all be trying to be as pleasant and decent to each other as possible, whether the law allows for it or not. I think as a society we should hold ourselves to a higher standard than the criminal law. If the highest standard we can set for ourselves and each other is the criminal law, that is an abysmally low standard." That was an article by Adam Robertson. The National, Thursday the 11th of April, from the news section. Labour takes the lead over SNP in YouGov poll for the first time since 2014. Labour have taken a slim lead over the SNP for the first time since the independence referendum, according to a major pollster. YouGov has placed Labour over the SNP for the first time in a decade, with Keir Starmer's party ahead 2 points. Labour are on 33%, while the SNP are on 31%. First time since 2014, the polling firm has recorded a lead from the former over the latter. The Tory vote has also slumped in Scotland, falling 6 points since October to 14%, with reform support growing from 2% to 7%. Elsewhere, the Lib Dems are on 7%, up 2 points since October, and the Green vote remains steady on 5%. Holyrood voting intentions are narrowing, with the SNP leading the constituency vote on 34%, 2 points ahead of Labour. When it comes to the regional vote, the two parties are neck and neck, with both sitting on 29%. The two parties had also been tied in October's poll at 28%. YouGov also found that support for independence was static since October, with 53% saying they would vote to remain in the Union, compared with 47% who would vote to leave. A Redfield and Wilton poll in February gave Labour a lead over the SNP, while the Ipsos Scottish Political Monitor gave Humza Yousaf's party a 7-point lead over Keir Starmer's. YouGov polled a representative sample of 1,100 people aged over 16 in Scotland between March the 25th and April the 2nd. That was an article by Hamish Morrison.
This is from The National on Thursday, 11th April 2024. From the comment section. Government must tackle the real burning issues for rural communities. By Leslie Riddoch. No more wood-burning stoves in new houses or renovations. It's hardly the stuff of revolutions, is it? And yet, for a lot of Scots living outside cities, it feels like a bit of a last straw. I live in a village in North Fife, just 20 minutes drive from the centre of Dundee across the Tay Bridge. Not really in the middle of nowhere. And yet there is no bus service, no collection of recycling materials, no gritter during winter, no shop, no durable road repairs, and no end to flooded roads, detours, delays, and expensive puncture repairs this winter. Mains gas was never installed here. Too few folk to justify the expense, and there have been 5 power failures so far this winter when locals were thrown back onto candles, tilly lamps, flasks, open fires, wood-burning stoves, and one another. The 40-odd people who live here probably are pretty odd, because we've adapted to living in a DIY community, learning to depend on one another and on ourselves, even though we pay full council tax. Now, I'm not trying to suggest this village is some off-grid, back-to-the-nature alternative community, though plenty exist on the west coast of Scotland. Au contraire, this village is 5 minutes off the main A92 through Fife. And that's the point. You don't need to live far from the madding crowd to be out in the sticks as far as service provision is concerned. And you either adapt to that, spend a lot of time complaining pointlessly, or head for a town or city. That's the backdrop for the wood-burning stove ban in rural Scotland. There's long been festering resentment at the lack of mainstream services, but folk have learned to work together and make the most of things. During Storm Arwen in November 2021, for example, all three roads out of this village were blocked by fallen trees. Happily, a team of with some very capable young locals with three chainsaws got one road clear by 8:30 a.m, so folk travelling to work or hospital could get out. Long experience suggested there was no point waiting for the overstretched council team. The trees were slowly removed, chopped up, stored, and used in fires and wood-burning stoves by folk in tied houses on the landed estates, making use of nature's windfall to compensate for having to rent drafty houses that are single-glazed, cold and often damp. No point complaining about any of that if you're not ready to face eviction and move out of the area, since there is next to no other affordable homes. And families with children are doubly stuck. Social housing rarely provides three-bedroom houses. So basically, the cavalry isn't coming to help. Not with the latest Land Reform Act, not with tenancy laws, not with more secure housing. Folk who live on the land on a low income are on their own. And the only change the Scottish Government is making is to block off the cheapest heating source for folk lucky enough to finally buy some old wreck and to do it up. Even brand new affordable social homes in Ardnamurchan have the same problem. I've heard families have moved out because they can't afford the white meter heating. Even though many work for Forestland Scotland and are surrounded by trees. Wood everywhere, but not a log to burn. And it's this firm belief that regulations in Scotland are devised for cities, then imposed on the country, that makes stove such an unexpectedly vexed issue. Take the now cancelled plans for highly protected marine areas, where a Scottish Government consultation asked islanders how they'd feel if fishing and even swimming were to end without compensation or any local control over exactly where and when that shutdown might occur and which businesses might close. Was anyone going to purr with anticipation over a proposal like that? That textbook exercise in top-down control came hot in the heels of another, the new National Planning Framework, NPF4. A powerful blueprint for planning slipped out in 2020, which swept away the old structure plans of Scotland's 32 councils, 2 national parks and 4 city regions, and replaced them all with one overarching policy framework that's city-shaped and plans in great detail for rural decline. The framework showcased spaceports and the blue economy, but remained silent on vital basic things like agriculture, land use and land reform, failing to build on the great ingenuity and courage of the Eggs, Noidarts and generations of crofters and farmers who've clung on, despite the system, for decades. Do professionals believe so little human capacity exists within rural Scotland that blank cheques for developers to build large urban-style housing in profitable clumps are as good as it gets? Why not plan a future with self-build, community-build as the rule, not the exception, so that small groups of houses at low cost can be built precisely where people need them? Or is the great fear that such grassroots empowerment would actually work, keeping small schools open and thereby increasing council costs? One section on NPF4 talks about creating 20-minute communities, where everything a citizen needs should be readily available on the doorstep. This would be funny if it wasn't so nakedly urban and utterly impractical for everywhere else. The Highlands contains areas the size of small European states without private childcare, hospital facilities, main roads or public toilets. Many elderly islanders are forced into mainland nursing homes because nothing is available within 2 hours of where they live, never mind 20 minutes. Islanders attend local government meetings via 3-day round trips. Come on. The whole 20-minute concept has been cut from an urban template and pasted onto rural communities, a fifth of the population, who need something bespoke and very different. It feels like we are heading for a future where rural life basically means living in Glasgow's overpriced urban fringe or in a volume house builder's estate round Inverness, while rural Scotland, 95% of our landmass, becomes the preserve of wealthy second home owners, faysooth. What a travesty that would be, since a green future needs more folk on the land for renewable energy, forestry, leisure and food production without food miles. Of course, NPF4 doesn't actually say move to Portree, Oban or Dumfries to make statutory services easier to deliver, but that's what it means. So, if country dwellers are off the grid, fine. Just leave us alone. If we're on, gonna help with the serious problems before you start micromanaging our stoves. Now, to be clear, I'm pretty sure every island community is acutely aware of overfishing, the climate crisis, exorbitant cost of relying on fossil fuels, and health impacts of using wood-burning stoves. But if rural Scots must accept living beyond the pale for most basic services, government must accept it canny pick and choose. If officialdom wants to intervene, it must first tackle the long list of serious problems endured by many rural Scots. No local GPs, no local post office. Mine is 9 miles away and I'm essentially suburban. No bus service, no affordable housing, no childminder, no dentist. But no, the first government intervention in country lives is to stop the only perk that comes from living near forests and woodlands. Now, to be fair, the new regulations ban stoves from new build homes and renovations, not existing ones. But it feels like wood has been slung in the truly dirty corner along with coal, oil and gas, even though it's renewable and most inhabitants of rural Scotland cannot afford an immediate switch to heat pumps. If this is Holyrood's main concern about rural living, it is the weirdest and most unworldly priority. That article was by Leslie Riddoch.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Fune Review and tell your friends about our service.